The idea behind this series came from me wanting to work with Phil. So thank you so much for coming to be here with me and Phil. I thought he might prove to be popular. But another reason...
I don't think they're here for me, but I'm very flattered.
But I think another reason for this series is to have a conversation about, do we have a bigger place in the world? Should our focus be insular towards our community? Is that what we're here for? To strengthen the Jewish community? What is our role as one of the largest communities in the UK? Or should we be more outward looking? My story starts in Nottingham quite a few years ago, when I ended up in Israel accidentally.
From Nottingham?
Yes.
Did you take a wrong turn on the A1 or something?
Yeah. In the air, yes, exactly. And accidentally during the war. So I arrived there to study in the conservative yeshiva, who was very kind and nice to me when I was a rabbinic student. And as sort of, as part of my loyalty to them, I used to go almost every year to kind of to pay back and to support them. And I went there 2 days before the war started, the war with Gaza. And people were greeting me by saying, "What are you doing here?" As Israelis do, you know, straight into your face. So why are you here? I was like, well, that was an accident. I didn't know that the war is about to start. And it was quite a surreal experience when I had to go to shelters, ma'amat, as they call in Hebrew, when we were walking in Tel Aviv in a promenade together with all my lovely student fellow students from America, you know, from Israel, from other parts of the world. And then the rocket was coming in and there was nowhere to hide. So we had to lie on the ground and record a rocket being caught actually literally in the air in front of our heads with Iron Dome. So that was really exciting. Mm-hmm. And by the end of it, I found myself leaving the tram, which I was on to go home. I stayed with my friends after the classes in the yeshiva, because I saw a Palestinian who behaved really strangely. And I got so paranoid. He didn't do anything, but he behaved strangely. Then I got scared and I left the tram, got off the tram. And then I was walking like three stops, long stops. Those who knows, it was a French, Givat Tzarfatit is the French hill, all the way there. I was thinking, would I do the same back home if I encountered a strangely behaved person? And I realized that I wouldn't. It was the first time, kind of the first moment of realization that after 4 weeks in Israel during the war and having all these experiences, not in real encounter of the war, but, you know, rockets, a constant threat of going to a shelter and hearing all the huge sirens, just the 4 weeks was enough for me to encounter the sense of fear, insecurity, and being scared of strangely behaved people. Only because he was Palestinian, I got scared. When I got back, I was really determined to do something about it. I just realized that I can't live in fear myself. I don't want my people to live in fear. So coming home, getting into a taxi from the Nottingham train station, all fresh from Israel, and what do I see? Huge, like 700 people meeting, gathering, manifestation of all the people around the BBC. I don't know how many people of you know outside of BBC, and was BDS supporters and against Israel. And I was completely broken. It was one of those days which I actually remember almost like minute by minute. I can tell you that, but the journey in the taxi, just thinking, what's going on? I just came from Israel, a bit heartbroken, seeing my people being so scared and understanding the sense of fear which this war creates and a conflict creates and wanting to do something about it. And I see 700 people, which is, for a small place, it's a huge number, manifesting there and saying no Israel and let's support Palestinians. And I decided that I have to do something about it. I can't just stay idle. Then we start receiving threats as a community. And the first thing which Nottingham citizens, and our synagogue was a proud member of Nottingham citizens, did after my return and when I reported the threats to them, they organized 50 faith leaders, faith and non-faith leaders in Nottingham, to write a letter of support in the local newspaper for our community. And I made myself a promise that if I want to bring a change to this world, I've got to do something about it. Just like those 50 leaders who rallied behind us and showed their sign of support, which meant so much to our community and to me, that I want to make the difference. And as a result of it, it was a conversation which I had with my colleague at the time, Nottingham Citizens, when we had a political campaign and we're trying to twist arm of the Conservative candidate, hoping that if they're going to win, which was a very, you know, slim prospect, but if they're going to win, whether they would commit to a living wage. And we had a conversation that, look, we can't live like this, being scared of each other, and he is Muslim. We've got to do something together to start breaking those prejudices and prejudices which we had against each other and build links between our communities. And we decided to start cooking together for the poor people of Nottingham. I'll tell you later more about what happened and how no one believed us and we couldn't get any money to support our project. We had literally to get pennies from different communities, from different people, because no organization believed that Jews and Muslims can work together. But 8 years later, last month, we celebrated our 8th anniversary and being registered as a charity. So that's where my interest comes from, when I realized that there are lots of things in the world which seem to be wrong, but we can't complain about it if we don't do anything about that. And that's where the beginning of this conversation comes from for me.
Well, sadly, that's all we've got time for this podcast. Not at all. First and foremost, how on earth can I follow on from that? I'm sure you agree that anyone who's here or who is maybe joining us via Zoom would agree just how inspirational that is. The fact that you saw a situation that upset you, and rather than just complain about it, you actually decided, I've got to do something about it. And sadly, I don't think there are many people who behave like that.
As you were saying, people moan and groan about these things, but they go, oh, it's not my problem, can't be bothered.
Yeah, and it's so true. This is exactly the point I make, is that if people really are outraged by a situation, then I think the only way to prove that is to actually take action. See, for me, there was actually something that Rabbi Tanya, you said right towards the start that interests me, where you said about how you saw someone behaving suspiciously and you feel that it was some sort of like maybe unconscious bias that made you behave the way you did towards them. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I don't care what background someone comes from. If I think they're behaving suspiciously, I'm going to run in the other direction and I don't care who knows it, right? Honest to goodness, I have no hesitation with that whatsoever. If I think that my life potentially is at threat or anything like that, of course I'm going to go in the opposite. I think that is actually human nature. I don't believe for a second that that's anything to do with being unconsciously biased towards someone who happens to be from another community or another background. But one thing I would say is that it's very interesting to me how we seem to live in a day and age where, despite the idea of multiculturalism supposedly being the norm, there seems to be more than ever, there seems to be things that divide us. And we're constantly reminding ourselves of what divides us and not unites us. If I give you an example, and this is going to be quite a controversial example, but I'm going to say it all the same. If people were to look at, say, the month of October in this country, I believe it is in other parts of the world as well, the month of October is known as Black History Month for many people. Now, I know the intentions are very good. The intentions behind Black History are to raise awareness for those who perhaps don't understand the persecution that people who are from the Black community or identify as having come from the Black community have gone through. Absolutely, the idea is there to raise awareness. But people often forget about the other side of that. And the other side of it is it's basically saying, well, hang on a second, if there is a month dedicated to Black history, why is there a month dedicated to Jewish history? And therefore, it's just causing, in my humble, division. So in exactly the same way that we've seen some of the scenes out of in America with the sort of propelling of the BLM movement, then that, again, all I heard was language that I hadn't heard for several years. being used in a bid to try and sort of almost tell people that all the time that we sort of maybe have thought one way, that we were wrong. So it is, I believe that there is sort of a concern to be had over just sort of what divides us rather than what unites us.
Yes, thank you. My name is Pancho Mulongeni, and I'm part of the conversion class. I just wanted to say regarding the whole idea of Black History Month, it's not just about Black people suffering persecution. Actually, it's about the achievements of Black people in this country. It's not supposed to be a month of victimhood, which is echoing what Rabbi Mark said earlier, that even when we do the discussion of the Jewish community versus other communities, it's not just about anti-Semitism. It's about amazing achievements of Jews. And there's nothing to stop this country from making a Jewish History Month. America has May as the Jewish History Month. So that's just something that needs to be promulgated. And I would actually say it doesn't cause division at all, because the history of this country has been to suppress the achievements of Black people. And there's a history of white supremacy in this country. Black History Month only tries to undo that a little bit by telling people, hey, there's so much to celebrate.
But you know, I think you hit the nail on the head there where you say the history of this country. That's what's important to me. It's not now. And that's where I think is so important. Again, if we sort of, unfortunately, and it's the same, I could argue very easily the same about situations surrounding, say, the way that we try and encourage the Holocaust to be taught in this country. Make no mistake, I agree that it's important that the lessons of the past are learnt. But it doesn't necessarily mean that people of the present should be blamed for those lessons of the past.
I actually worked on an event at Wembley, Black History Live, and I worked on the Black History magazine. And it was, as he says, very much about their history in this country and the achievements. We had the RAF Museum there with the first black pilots going back to the First World War. You know, football clubs, nurses that were here, and it was very much celebrating their history here, which I think young black kids don't realise that they are part of the history here. So it was important.
Arguments that I have heard to sort of almost like the counter of that, I'm not personally saying whether or not sort of I agree or disagree with something like Black History Month, and I'm sorry to pick on that. I'm using it as an example. My original example came from the number of situations we find ourselves in this day and age that cause more division rather than uniting people. The bottom line is that if you were to cut someone's wrist, blood runs through it, okay? That is all we need to know. That's all that matters, in my humble opinion. What happens in the past, we can learn from it, but I don't think that what happens in the past should be dwelled on to such a degree that it actually seems to cause more harm to unite society than to bring them together in this day and age.
But isn't that the famous expression, conquer, divide and conquer? And I think sometimes it makes it much easier for politicians, particularly in some authoritarian regimes, to put different faith groups and different people against each other for that very reason, because it's much easier to control people. When the fear rules communities and communities are not working together, it's much easier to manipulate them, certainly against each other.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I couldn't agree more, but I'd also suggest that it is the case that I think that until people sort of adopt a mindset for themselves of knowing that there's more that unites than divides. And until we actually focus on that, then I just don't see anything changing. Even if it is like a politician's intention, I try to refuse to believe that people are that sheep-minded, that they would just blindly follow with it. I believe that there is more, I think it's deeper. I just think it's a case of that people sort of see a narrative and they run with it, if you like.
Okay, what I'd like to say as part of human experience is that creation itself has created division. All of us are divided by our cultures, the way in which we believe, we think. Even amongst families, there are divisions. So division is a natural force. The thing that is different about division is that we come in different levels of understanding. Some of us are very good. Some of us are good, some of us are damn nasty and evil. is another part of that division. So the world is completely and utterly in conflict with itself at all levels. As we know that when we mix in societies, mix extremely well.
I guess it boils down to sort of the almost like the human nature that is birds of a feather. I mean,
well,
it sounds
even the level of class. You know, we come from different classes.
Yeah, some of us certainly do.
We like to divide each other amongst those classes.
Actually, that's a really interesting point, though, because I suppose that you could actually say that based on the class system of old was how politicians used to control and divide society. Mm. Of course, now, because the class system has almost been erased, thankfully, to some degree. I mean, I say thankfully. I mean, part of me thinks it's a shame, but the other part of me thinks, thank goodness. You know, well, look, what can I say? You know, I don't speak like this for nothing. But the other part of it is that if the class system is as good as no more, then obviously there are other ways in which I suppose the powers that be need to try and find a way of keeping us separate.
But don't you think that community and our community and any Jewish community is a good example of overcoming those boundaries? Because we're here with different political views, and as a rabbi, we're particularly aware of that. You know, when you, for example, write a sermon, you need to make sure that you're apolitical, that you don't kind of, you know, don't touch any kind of very hot topics which people have very strong views about. Israel is quite a good topic for that. We have all the extremes on the right and the left and everything in between, but we're still together as a community. So we've got the sense of identity and belonging which unites us despite of the differences between us. Do you think it's possible as humanity to use the same principle to work the, I don't know, is it such a word in English, betterment of humanity? Because it seems to me, and I'm of a certain age, lady of a certain age, I'm not telling you.
Younger than the rest of us.
And because of that, I've seen life. And there are moments when I've tried to do lots of charitable work, I've tried to do all the right things in my life, and sometimes I feel like I got stuck. I wish the world was a better place, and then another war starts. Or I see people behaving in a very unethical way. I've seen politicians, particularly when I got involved with politics, behaving in a very unethical way and lying openly. And you feel disheartened. So is there any chance for us to make our society better, as you said, if we know that there are natural ways of dividing us? Or is it what we have now, that's what we have?
What I would say on that front is that I believe that as long as everyone has the understanding that everyone in this world is entitled to their opinion, no matter how abhorrent you might find it or one might find it, but everyone is entitled to their opinion, to their belief system, their religion, their identity, whatever they want, but, and there is a big but to this, as long as they don't inflict it on others or expect other people to follow suit. Because I'm telling you for nothing, that is where I think we go wrong. Again, I'm going to use another quite controversial example here, so you forgive me. I'm not trying to be offensive when I say this. I'm merely highlighting what I observe, and I look through very political eyes, so forgive me. But I can't help but observe that, say, a lot of movement in recent years has been towards being more, quite rightly, understanding towards, say, the trans community and towards those of different gender identity. Now, it may be that the world has been wrong for a great number of years towards those who identify as a different gender or are going through some sort of transition. And let me be very clear when I say, I think anyone who wants to take on the narrative of the world like that is a very brave person, because they must know what resistance they're going to come up against, and that can't be an easy decision to make. So I think to anyone who wants to put themselves through that journey is nothing but absolutely admirable. However, if you turn around to others and tell them that the majority of people have been thinking incorrectly for all these years, that is going to be met with resistance. And I think that's one of the biggest problems. Again, it's about sort of telling people they're wrong to think the way they do. That's what causes a lot of division, in my humble.
Phil, you've said that the word kind of moving, the pendulum is moving towards the people folk who, you know, thinking about changing gender and find themselves in those kind of grey zones of a sense of self-identity. Mm. But if you look around of some other countries, it's not at all. Literally, like the world around us, particularly where the regimes are authoritarian, they're moving the other way around. And now even those rights which were fought very hard for LGBTQ community, they've been lost. And I don't know whether you've read what's happening in Italy.
Yes, for those who don't know, by the way, in Italy, example, is that there was a motion this week that was passed that said that same-sex couples who are parents, only one parent can be put on a birth certificate, because the notion is there's one mother, one father, you can't have two mothers, you can't have two fathers.
And if you vote, or if one votes for an extremist government, what do they expect? Because the same exactly was happening in Nazis' Germany towards the Jews. They didn't start killing Jews straight away. It took 10 years to get to the kind of idea of extermination. But the discrimination started very slowly. So obviously, if you've got an extremist regime in Italy, that's the first movements, and they were very clear about their agenda too.
But don't you think, and that again, like I said, I suppose I'm just putting the opposite view here as opposed to actually saying how I think, but don't you believe that there are plenty of people out there who do think along those lines and say that parentage is in the form of one mother, one father? Now, I think that most of us around this table are sensible to know that that is not necessarily the case, but there are a lot of people who do think like that. And I suppose that what I was trying to get at with my previous point is that by turning to people and saying, you have been thinking this wrong all these years, mm-hmm. it is going to be met with resistance. And that form of resistance is the rise of the far right, if you see what I mean. Whereas if there was more understanding and acceptance that some people have some situations, others have others, but you are not wrong to think the way you think, you just happen to think differently, surely that is more likely to unite people than to divide them in the way that it has, especially over given what's happened in Italy.
Completely agree with you. Tolerance is the virtue which we can't take for granted and takes a long time to cultivate, that's for sure.
Everyone has the right to be what they want to be, but don't push it on others. And I don't agree with the teachers that were sacked who gave their opinion. They said, and they were dismissed. University teachers.
The teachers you're referring to are the ones who were saying about the biological sex of somebody. Was that it?
One of the occasions, but it was the having the same different toilets and using the same toilet. And J.K. Rowling, I mean, I agree with her. You know, everyone has their right, and I feel quite, it's just tough for people who want to be another agenda. But don't, and it seems more so more now, they're pushing it on you, really pushing on you, and I don't like being pushed.
But that's sort of what I was saying, is exactly that, is that if something is forced upon somebody and what happens is you're telling someone that all of these years, what you've been taught, what you've been brought up to believe, what your personal beliefs are wrong, that is not going to be well received, because it's human instinct, it's human nature to A, resist change, and B, to be defensive, you know, to protect you. But with that in mind, I suppose actually sort of what would be quite interesting, Rabbi Tanya, is actually sort of what is it that Judaism actually teaches us about tolerance? Because one would assume that sort of there is some sort of conflict within our religion going on, in so much as that obviously we are taught from a very early age that we are the chosen ones. But at the same time, we're also taught to sort of love one another and not sort of not cause any harm to anyone. So where do we actually sit religiously?
Well, I think we're in a cognitive dissonance, and there are quite a few texts, particularly in the Talmud, which talks about us being chosen people. And rabbis really kind of wrestle with what does it mean to be chosen? And there is everything from the, you know, arrogant, we are the best because we accepted the Ten Commandments, to we should be an ethical and moral example to all other nations. So there is much more responsibility on our shoulders for that very reason. Because we are chosen, we should be the best in ethical and moral behavior. But also there is a quite a stream of different texts and discussions about Goyim and people who are not Jewish people, and you know, Goy actually means nations, but it's eventually with time, particularly during medieval time and later, when Jews were discriminated so much against and expelled from so many places, the sense of resentment, in some way, I think what you feel we're talking about, started within the Jewish community. So Jewish people start having a very negative attitude to anything outside of the Jewish world, the Jewish community. They don't want us, we don't want them either. So there is clearly some sort of resentment within some of the Jewish teachings toward anything which could influence our pure kind of, you know, Jewish sense of life, and kashrut laws and lots of laws which separate us from the rest of the world. And obviously, rabbis naturally were also concerned about assimilation, and certainly in latter years, and that also reflected in halakha. So we have this cognitive dissonance of, on the one hand, we are there for the world, and world is important for us to engage with the world. And on another hand, we have to be really separate from the world because there is us and we have direct connection with God, and there are them. Don't mix.
I was just going to say, because we've experienced so much persecution as a religion, as a culture, as a society, shouldn't we be the ones who should be showing the world how to be more tolerant of other people and setting that example to others, because we've experienced it so much ourselves, rather than doing it the same to other people? Also, it does say in some places that we should be respecting the rules of the nation that we are a part of, which is why some people do circulate within to society. And I don't see that as a bad thing, because by being around different groups of people is only going to make people more tolerant of one another. But yes, we've had like lots of really negative experiences in the past, but that puts us in good stead to support other people and other groups of people, such as, you know, supporting like Asian history and Asian Art History Month, which is happening at the moment, and then Black History Month as well. And I know before you were saying that we shouldn't necessarily dwell too much in the past and what's happened in the past, but that's sometimes the only way you can teach people, you know, how to be better today and how to improve themselves. But also there are some events that happen in Black History Month as well, where you're talking about today in the present moment and what we should be doing now to help challenge people within the workplace and other groups as well. And sometimes you don't come across parts of history or parts of different culture unless you're attending those events in the workplace as well. So that only enables people to become more tolerant of other people. There's also a huge thing around intersectionality. You know, even with in Judaism, you know, there's people of different ethnicities, different backgrounds as well. So as a group, we should be more tolerant of that as well, and showing that to, so, you know, the rest of society as well. There's also elements on disability, where people have disabilities, health conditions, neurodiversity, and they're still, you know, being persecuted in the workplace for being different as well. And as you know, by having experience of our past, we should be showing people that actually, as a group, as a society, this is how we can be more tolerant of other people's differences.
Which, don't get me wrong, it, in theory, is a very nice idea. And it all sounds sort of idyllic. But unfortunately, the reality that I have seen, you know, and maybe I might be in a minority, I hope I am, but I have seen an awful lot of people who just seem to go the other way. What they see is that there is a narrative that is being almost, if you like, rammed down their throats, whether they like it or not, and it makes them resist. It actually says, well, hang on a second, if you're just going to blame me for something that generations...
But I think that's where you've got to stop. It's not about blaming people, it's creating awareness. So I'm a disability advocate, I'm a neurodiversity advocate in the workplace. I'm not telling, oh, you're wrong because of your belief and how you think brains work differently. I'm telling people that you need to be, you know, that you can be better as individuals, and you can create awareness and create more inclusive environments and workplaces by doing X, Y, and Z. I'm not jamming it down a throat that they're completely wrong, but just showing that we can be better and helping people to understand different viewpoints and perspectives and not saying you're wrong. I think we can have conversations and have open conversations without telling people that they're wrong and jamming it down our throat and being open-minded to one another. And I think that's important. Having that open communication is important, and that's what enables people to understand one another as well, rather than that negative connotation.
Morris Hoffman, I think we're going to recognise that in the Torah and the Bible, it wasn't all sweet and nice.
It wasn't. There was
double crossing. I mean, the invasion of Canaan, the promised land, was a war. I think we've got to recognise that. But in terms of, we are a minority here, and so it's in our interest to ensure that we live that the society we live in is stable. Because if it's not stable, minorities will get blamed. That's what always happens. Another thing we've not heard about is the control of government, the Nazis, Russia. The government and the state is all powerful. And once you control things like the media, what's taught in schools, etc., this is what the Nazis did, other authoritarian states. Once you control that, the message goes out consistently, and then you get the blame of the other. So it's in our interest, really, to ensure stability, to ensure that minorities don't get labelled. This goes all the way back to 1905 and the Aliens Act, and filthy Jews, and don't let them in. So politically...
How did that work for them?
So what I think is politically that you know, we all want to live our lives, and we don't necessarily want to know that we're friendly with these groups or those groups. So we're looking for stability, we're looking for a peace, and anything in Parliament that talks about minorities and about sending people in home and stopping boats, it could be other people, it was us. So I think this is what we're looking for. So, and some of it is political. So I don't care what people think about me, but I do care when they start talking and into groups. And you were quite lucky, Tanya, getting people to work with you. Because sometimes, you know, we all want to do things, but we don't know how to get together or do. So we have to think about that.
It wasn't easy. Lots of success stories have hard work behind them, and people don't talk about it. And our steering group, because actually, do you remember it was Charlie Hebdo thing happening at the time? And we had two steering group committees resigning. First it was the Jewish side, then there was the Muslim side. It wasn't easy to work together, because what was lacking is trust. And you can only earn trust by building relationships and by getting to know each other. And I'm not trying to pretend that, you know, that trust is firmly in place. I think trust always in any relationship, particularly between different faith groups, is very fragile, but it's worth building that. Because I love that, you know, the pastor in Germany, I keep forgetting his name because it was German and very, very long, but beautifully said about when they came, you know, to get the communist, I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. And then when they came for the gay people, I didn't speak up because I wasn't the gay person. And then when they came for the Jews, I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. But when they came for me, there was no one else left to, you know, to stand up for me. And for me, it's very much now a principle in life, just thinking, what can we do as a minority? Or can we do anything? And people have different answers to that. Some people prefer to focus within the Jewish community, just think as long as we're okay, the rest of the world doesn't matter. Or people like me who now I think, no, it does matter. And I believe very strongly in interfaith, for example, because I think so many people gave us out, so to say. You know, so many people during the Second World War, I mean, so many people murdered the Jews and gave them in to the police. But there were some, you know, righteous among the nations, there were some people, non-Jewish people, who saved Jewish people. And without them, so many, you know, thousands of Jews wouldn't be here today. So we are among those now people, minorities as well. can we do something? Can we help the world to be a better place by learning from our experiences and turning that negative narrative and negative baggage which we carry with us into something positive, in building relationship with the faith communities, getting to know each other, building those relationships and earning the trust so that it can lead to a better future and being there for each other? Because I think when there is trust and understanding, fear then disappears.
The pastor you speak of, Martin Niemöller.
Why do people always have to pick out the Jews? I originally come from South London, and we didn't have, I didn't even know Northwest London existed when I grew up.
Wait, you're telling me there's a South London?
But you could always tell that if you're in a group, people will always say they're Jewish. But why are we so different? We go out to work, we look after our families, we mix in, we're perfectly all right. But there will always be non-Jewish people, they will always say, oh, they're Jewish people over there. And this I'm afraid you live with this, and I've lived with it for all my life. It makes no difference. When I was in business, they would always just say, and my mother was in business, well, that shop's owned by the Jew girl. You just take it on your shoulders. Hard luck, you know, it goes off your shoulders. You just take it as part of life, and that's it.
I went to the Royal Ballet School, and my sister and I were the only Jewish girls. And you can imagine, you killed our Christ, and you're a Jew. Well, I didn't just take it on the chin.
I mean, I didn't think you looked that old, to be honest. But
I gave him a punch on the nose.
Oh, good work.
That's what I did. For you.
Obviously, we don't condone that kind of behaviour, but yes.
No, no. They didn't dare report me, but they didn't do it again. And a lot of the other girls, I took on a few. And I was a skinny little kid, you had to be, at the Royal Ballet School. But no, probably because I lost my parents when I was 7. So I had quite a tough upbringing. And no, nobody was going to, not with me.
Rabbi Tony was saying about working together. What is very noticeable, since the Salman Rushdie event, you know, it brought Palestinians and Muslims from all over the world together. Because prior to that, I worked with lots of young Muslim girls. Well, you talk about casual, we compared things, what we had in common, you know, and then suddenly the same girls, they've got their heads, you know, they became more right-wing in what they were thinking. So there hasn't always been that huge gap at all between Jews and Muslims. It seemed to happen from then, and it's widened. And now there is a competition between who's the most, you know, what are the worst things that have happened to this group or that group? When you get Whoopi Goldberg saying that Nazis, it wasn't about race. Well, come on there.
Well, I mean, who knew? I mean, even the Nazis admit it was about race. I don't quite know what Whoopi Goldberg knows.
Goldberg, yeah.
But anyway, so there you go.
How dare she steal our name? Anyway, that was... it's almost has become a competition. Whereas we should be kind of working.
But that goes back completely to the point I was making earlier. And I said that I really worry how detrimental a lot of this modern interfaith work is actually causing. I'm not suggesting for a moment that it isn't essential that all communities should meet in understanding and come together. In fact, actually, one of my favourite lines that we actually sort of read on a Saturday, typically we'd say it in Hebrew, I can't remember the Hebrew off the top of my head, but it's so that it actually sort of is in the Siddur, the way we actually sort of say maybe that everyone meets in understanding. You know, it's one of my favourite lines on a Saturday morning. However, I think that sort of we need to have an understanding at basic level of what that means. You know, if meeting understanding means that we're not all thinking the same way, but it doesn't matter if we're not thinking the same way. And that's why I believe that recent years has actually been more detrimental to interfaith than actually previous years when people just got on with it and didn't actually declare their anything. I remember a time, it wasn't that long ago, when sort of, you know, my parents were always saying to me, never tell anyone you're Jewish. You don't say anything, just keep it to yourself. And they were doing it to actually in some weird way, to protect me because they didn't want me to face any anti-Semitic behaviour. But it was, I mean, I personally have no hesitation whatsoever in telling people I'm Jewish, you know, whether I'm in, if obviously, I mean, I keep it quiet if I'm in a synagogue, but if I'm actually, if I'm out and about, then absolutely I have no hesitation with telling people. And, you know, maybe I don't look it, I don't behave it, but even so.
I think people do accept that they're Jewish now and they're not frightened. But I just want to make you laugh. I came across one young lady, and she said to me, she was looking at me and she was helping me, and she said, "Are you Jewish?" I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "I've never met a Jewish person before."
I was just going to say, but I think interfaith all depends on like how you go about it. I was part of the first interfaith network at one of the departments I used to work for, and it was about people understanding that it's okay to bring their full selves to work, which is important. It wasn't about forcing different viewpoints on one another. It was just about having this open communication to learn about different religions, different cultures, different backgrounds, different faith, whether it's religion or belief, and creating that open platform. And we had like this wonderful time around December where the different faith groups and different belief groups put on events around the topic around light. So there was events around Hanukkah, Diwali, the pagan festivals as well. And everyone kind of got involved, and it was just like a beautiful way of doing it, you know, accepting everybody's different beliefs, different cultures and different ways of doing things and just coming together. And I think that's a beautiful way of doing something without forcing different ideologies and beliefs onto one another and just accepting each other with who we actually are and allowing people to bring their full selves into a situation and to an event. And I think that's a good way forward within like this communication.
Yeah, so you see, the thing is though, that where with your point that you made there, I'm not saying that I disagree that the interfaith events and history months and all of those are not well-intentioned, because for what it's worth, I believe they're very well-intentioned. I think that good people at heart set them up in an attempt to make the world a more tolerant and a more understanding place. I think that anyone who says otherwise probably doesn't understand the intention behind them. However, I believe that it is set up without an understanding of how people could react to those particular events or those particular history months. The truth is that there are a number of people, rightly or wrongly, who believe that they do cause more division than they actually solve. And as a result of it, it sort of could potentially be quite detrimental. I don't think it could be any coincidence that sort of in my lifetime anyway, I don't really sort of remember this much unrest and this much sort of division and dis-ease, if you like, amongst different communities. I would actually go so far as to say that 20 years ago, I feel that we were more tolerant as a society than we are now, and I wholeheartedly believe that.
I think you're controversial just for the sake of being controversial, Phil. I just disagree with you strongly, because I grew up in a former Soviet Union, and I wouldn't call that society very tolerant at all 20 years ago. And maybe in the UK, possibly, because...
So forgive me, that's my reference, is I mean the UK.
Yeah, in the UK, absolutely. But I just think there is something about the world in the recent years which becoming really intolerant. And I think for us as a Jewish community, and that's partly sort of, I'll tell you another reason for this series just in a minute. Kevin, just wait for a bit longer. I'll finish. But
you've got to give these things time, Kevin. You've only waited 50 minutes to talk. So.
Economic, yes. I'm sorry. Rabbis don't stop, as you know. You know, they say goodbye, but never leave and never stop talking. And economic upheaval always brings up those divisions within the people. And we are living exactly that time. And, you know, economic crisis we are living through now and the recession we are living through now, you need to find someone to blame. And Jews traditionally were blamed, or other minorities, some other countries. And that's exactly what we see now happening. One of the interesting things for me now, going back to another reason for this series, was becoming friends with who's a really dear one of my best friends now, a lovely person, and she is Armenian, and she actually is from Nagorno-Karabakh. And one of the points of our sort of reference of the beginning of our friendship was for her to say that it's really interesting the Jews who were mostly persecuted so much, and Israel, which is obviously full of Jewish people, one would have thought, would not recognize Armenian genocide, which was done by Turkey in 1915. Even though more than 1 million of Armenians, depending, you know, which source you believe, were murdered, and it was a genocide, Israel would not recognize it. And it's interesting that Hitler quoted Armenian genocide when they had this big meeting and big discussion about extermination of the Jews. And he said, look, more than 1 million of Armenians were slaughtered and the world said nothing. We shouldn't be worried about that. So apparently it was recorded as the quote. And for me, that was kind of a point of reference, thinking, here we go. You know, so we're so consumed by our own horror and sorrow. And I was actually quite embarrassed to realize that Israel does not recognize Armenian genocide. And there is a lot of politics around it, which is not the conversation for now. We'll have a talk about that. But there is something about minorities and us as the Jews thinking about whether we could make a difference in the world, as you say, which is doesn't look far from ideal at the moment.
I sort of agree and both disagree with both Tanya and Phil. I think definitely in the past 20 years...
That is
years,
such a Jewish response.
I know. I can have two opinions at once, and here comes a third. That I certainly over the past 20 years, and it is proven, there's a thing called the Overton window, which basically is a political model that shows us things move one side to the other, left or right, the more everything else moves. And that's why people say Labour has moved more to the right or more to the centre, because the government politics in this country has definitely moved right. Now, I think a lot of the division in this country is being stirred up by the media, as Morris says. You just have to, you know, the obsession with trans isn't a left-wing obsession. It's not a centrist obsession. In fact, probably most people aren't that bothered about it. It's a Daily Mail and the Express fascination. And that's where it's pushing it down people's throats. So how many people can actually say that they have been in a position where they personally have been influenced or affected by somebody to do with trans issues or a racism issue, or somebody pushing homosexuality on them? Probably very, very few. But you read the media and you think it's absolutely rampant. And I think we have to bear that in mind. And talking about the Jewish context, you know, you don't know who the media is going to pick on next. So I think it's always be very mindful about what you're reading and always take it with a little pinch of salt.
Kevin, but don't you think that media has its own agenda, and that behind every media, there are people who financially support it? And that's exactly what happened in any authoritarian regime. People learn about the policies of government, depending on regime's policies, through the media. That's how the ideology these days works. And in a democratic world as well, it's just a bit more democratic, but there are still, you know, every media has its own agenda.
Speaking as someone who does work in media, sorry, Kevin, I know that was aimed at you and I absolutely wanted to answer that, but speaking as someone who does work in media, I would like it known that I don't personally have an agenda, and I don't believe the company I work for has an agenda, but I also believe that most media outlets know their audience, and that's very different to having an agenda. So I think that's important to note that difference. Sorry, Kevin, absolutely, you need to answer that.
I think that is correct. I agree, and I also disagree. That I think it depends what media you're dealing with. And I think the BBC is a prime example, because if you ask somebody who aligns politically with the left, they would say at the moment the BBC is very right wing. If you ask someone who's white right wing, they'll say it's left wing. I saw exactly the same argument with a website that I followed this week going on Facebook. Now, Facebook doesn't care about left or right. Facebook cares about money. And most of the social media platforms care about money and what gets clicks and what gets people through. So they will put clickbait media on there in order to get people to click through to it. And then you get into an echo chamber and you'll just show more and more and more of the same stuff. I think in terms of media, most people know that the Daily Mail is funded and the Telegraph is funded by the same people who fund the Tories. Most people probably know that, that Labour is funded by the same people that own the Daily Mirror. I think as long as we have some clarity and understanding of what we're seeing, and I think that's the challenge with social media, it's hidden. And so we all of a sudden think that what we're being shown is a particular narrative, and we've lost the ability to hold multiple views at the same time. So whilst we joke about the Jewish thing of being able to hold multiple views, there is nothing wrong with being able to with holding multiple views and being influenced. When something has to be so binary that it's absolute fact, even if you have only heard it once, that's when things become very dangerous.
Thank you, Kevin. I tell you, the only, just one thing I wanted to pick up on, something that you said just a little earlier on when you started talking, is that you were saying that there are very few of us who have possibly experienced the changes in society that actually sort of are geared more towards an understanding towards, say, transgender or LGBTQ rights or anything like that. And I actually would go so far as to say that I disagree with that, because especially in a workplace environment, I think that many workplaces now are more consciously aware, and some might say quite rightly, but more consciously aware of other communities who may work there. And obviously, as a result of it, they would put certain measures in place to try and make sure that those members of that community are more supported. So I actually slightly disagree. I think that people do, from that perspective, have it, if you like, sort of shoved down their throats, but not necessarily because it's a bad thing. They just might resist the change, what we were saying a little earlier on about resisting change. But full circle with this, because we are rapidly running out of time, but just full circle on this, what I would say is that everything that I've done about you, but I've heard so far throughout this discussion, can be attributed to pretty much what I was saying earlier, and that is a recognition that people have different opinions and they have different beliefs, and that without appreciating that someone is more than likely going to think differently to you on at least one subject, one matter, one belief, whatever it is, until we get that back, I wholeheartedly believe that the society that we probably all dream of is doomed to failure, because I don't see it as possible. You're never going to get everyone thinking the same way. Mm-hmm. So the only alternative is getting people to realize that we don't all think the same way.
Absolutely, but I think you both kind of said the same thing. It's about the values of value of tolerance and the value of understanding. And they both are not easy to achieve, but something for us to strive for if we want to maintain the diversity of opinion and the tolerance of the diversity within our society. That's what democracy is. It's not the best institution, but the only one we have so far. So we have to work hard to achieve that.
On that note, I think all that's left to say is thank you very much indeed to those of you who have listened to this podcast. I hope you found it interesting and possibly even insightful as well. And just in case you were wondering the voices you were listening to, my name is Phil Dave.
And Robert Anisaknovich.
I'm Kevin Darville.
I'm Zoe.
I'm Shirley.
I'm Sarah.
I'm Melvin.
I'm Morris.
I am Pancho.
I am Tina Hart.